howdy. Welcome to Blind Like Me again on a rainy Monday in East Texas. It is the, today is the 20th day of the month of March. I don't know when this will run, but this is when we're recording on the 20th of March. We'll go out to California to Jonathan Rawlings, sir. How are you this morning?
Doing good. How about you?
Well, I'm good. It's a rainy old day. You say you wish you were here. You love storms.
Yeah, I love big storms. I lived in Arkansas for a little while, and I missed the storms back there.
You lived in Arkansas.
I lived in Arkansas for a short time.
Well, boy, if you lived in Arkansas, you got some storms in the spring, just like we do.
Yeah, I loved it.
It's that season where we have at least one big sort of destructive storm that comes through. And this isn't it. This was just a lot of rain that Gulf moisture that came up, cooled temperatures off a little bit. What age are you, sir?
I am 29 years old.
29, just a child.
I'm a youngin.
Just a youngin. Now, your level of vision is what?
I guess they call me a low partial. I can see shapes and figures and colors, but I have major problems with seeing things that are very far away. I can't drive a car, and I can't read street signs, but I can use a CCTV and a computer with speech.
That's what I was going to say. You can see, you've got a CCTV and your computer, I guess you have some sort of screen magnification that you use on that?
Not a magnification. I use the Windowize speech program.
Oh, do you?
And I use that in conjunction with my sight, with little sight I have, but that's just mainly to see what's on the screen. The Windowize actually reads me the text.
Yeah, mostly you're relying on Windowize to get around in your... on your computer, right?
Right.
And how long have you been partially blind? Were you born like this, or what?
No, I was born with normal vision, but when I was about 2 years old, my parents, woke up one Sunday morning to find that I had quite a high fever, and it got high enough that they took me into the hospital, and I was diagnosed with encephalitis.
Oh.
Which I think is an infection of the brain in the spinal cord area, and I immediately went into a coma for 6 weeks, and the doctors had told my parents that if he ever comes out of it, the swelling and the pressure on his brain is most likely going to cause if he comes out of it, will cause mental handicaps, severe mental handicaps, may never walk. We don't know how extensive the damage is going to be, but chances are very high that when he wakes up, you won't have the same kid who went into the coma 6 weeks ago. But as it turns out, the only damage to the visual cortex in the brain, and we think maybe some minor nerve damage, like my feet and in the tips of my fingers, I have a slight loss of sensitivity, which is why I've never learned Braille. So I guess compared to what the doctors expected, I came out pretty much on top.
You came out. We talk to people, blind people, all the time that were oxygen deprived and kids that had too much oxygen and because of the over oxygenation, they lost their eyesight. Well, but they lived. So, as you know, at 29 years old, a blind person can do a lot and have a good life. That's our premise here is to kind of prove that or to let people know that. So encephalitis, now if that's contracted by, carried by mosquitoes, or how did you know?
I know there is a strain of encephalitis that's mosquito-borne. I honestly don't know, and the doctors didn't know then how I could have contracted it. It was a fairly rare, at least back in 78, it was... I think it was a rare strain that doctors weren't used to seeing, but we never found out how I came down with it.
There's no explanation for some things, is there?
There isn't.
Some things just happen. Huh? Yeah, there's stuff happens, or that's not what they say, but we'll let that go. We'll let it go right there. So we're clean family show that we're having here. So 2 years ago, you don't remember having full sight, do you?
No. My parents tell me, that when they brought me home from the hospital, and after I'd learned to crawl again, I had to learn some of my motor skills back, but my my dad used to get down on his hands and knees and chase behind me, and I'd crawl away from him, and he would realize that when I would move, you know, when I would be crawling, my head would turn to the side. I have no tunnel vision whatsoever. All of my vision is peripheral.
Really?
When I look at things, my head is actually turned to the side, which, of course, really throws off sighted people. You know, look at me when I'm talking to you. That was when my parents, it was a couple of months before they realized my sight had even been affected.
Oh, okay. Because I guess you still could do normal things. I mean, you could see to eat and you didn't know the difference. You're just 2 years old. You couldn't be expected to know anything had happened.
Right.
So you don't remember anything about this operation. This is all history that's been told to you.
That's correct. The only memory and it's almost like remembering a dream, but I do seem to have some recollection of being brought home. It doesn't make any sense to me either.
Yeah.
But I seem to have some recollection of being brought home and set on a blanket that my grandma had made for me while I was in the hospital. And I remember my brothers and sisters were cheering that I had finally made it home and was still in one piece.
How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have one older sister, two older brothers, and then a younger sister.
So
there's a total of five of us, and I'm number four.
And the rest of them all see fine, see perfectly good, well, right?
Yeah, that's right. My dad is diabetic, and he has actually he just had cataract surgery, so he's been in communication with me about the frustrations of not being able to see. And I said, Dad, you can still drive a car. So when you can't drive, then you come talk to me.
You give us a call then. Other than that, if you can still drive the car, then you ain't blind, buddy.
But except for wearing a pair of prescription glasses and all that, not everyone else in my family has perfect vision.
Now, you alluded to the fact that you lived in Arkansas. Did all this take place in Arkansas? Where were you when all this happened?
I was just in Arkansas for a very short time, but I've lived in Las Vegas my entire life.
So you went to that center in Arkansas for training, right? Was that it? No?
No, I actually got to volunteer to help. I've actually been to there's a school for the blind in Little Rock, and I got to volunteer there. But what I was doing there was actually related to my religious beliefs. I was there for I bounced all over the South for a couple of years. I lived in Little Rock up north in Mountain View. And I even got into Tennessee, and I love Tennessee, northeast of Memphis there by Jackson.
But you currently live in Las Vegas.
Yes, I'm currently in Las Vegas.
I said California. I went a little far west there, didn't I?
That's all right. I hadn't told you previously where I lived, and all you knew to go on was Pacific time, and everybody thinks California.
Well, I think I saw a post that you sent something about you, because that convention in 2005 was in Las Vegas, the ACB convention, right?
Yes, and I wanted to go, and I wasn't able to make it. I was working my externship for school at the time.
Yeah, so you didn't make the convention. Well, I've been to Las Vegas. In fact, Luann and I got married in Las Vegas. I don't know how it would be to live. I love to visit there, but I don't know. I just don't know how it would be to live. I don't know how susceptible I would be to the slot machines, because I love.
You know, I'm sure people in New York City kind of take their attractions for granted, and people that live near Disneyland probably, it's Disneyland, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's the same with us. We're up here, and the Strip is down there, and the Strip is where the tourists go, and we have our lives out. I mean, for sighted people, obviously, you fly over Las Vegas at night, and you very quickly realize there's a hell of a lot more there than just the Strip.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
We've got over 1.5 million people, and we've got some... They estimate 4,000 to 5,000 people move here every month. So there's a lot more here than just the casinos.
But gambling is pervasive there, in that when you get off the plane in the airport, there are slot machines.
That's how I've always known when I'm home, is when I walk off the airplane and I can hear the slot machines and the advertisements for the shows on the Strip. How I know I'm home.
Well, my wife goes twice a year with some college friends of hers. And I've been out there two or three, I think three times we've been to Vegas. I went to a little seminar there one time. The guy was going to teach me how to do radio production. And it was five classes. I went to one of them. I knew more than he did. There wasn't much point in going. Anyway, I would think it would be a great city, but if people think Las Vegas is a high desert, it gets really hot.
Yes.
In Las Vegas.
And if I ever get an opportunity with my newfound career options to leave Las Vegas, I am out of here. Because the climate is so not to my liking. I'm one of these people. I think I was born to live in the snow, but I got displaced. So if it gets above 80 degrees, I'm already uncomfortable.
Well, you're uncomfortable 6 months of the year, then.
I'm uncomfortable about 8 months of the year. And it was no picnic having to dress up in a chef's jacket and long pants and walk the three blocks that I did all last summer to my externship job.
I thought they talk about, the dry heat's not bad. Well, that's bull.
Yeah, well, I've got a friend that likes when it gets hot like that. He always tells me that there's a sign on the gate of hell that says, "Don't worry, it's a dry heat."
Yeah, well, that doesn't make any difference. That dry heat is a. So I've been out there in the summer, but when it was, and I've got a friend that deals in Laughlin, so we spent some time in Laughlin, Nevada, which is, as you know, is a 45 minutes south of Las Vegas.
Right on the Colorado River.
It's, yeah, really.
It even gets hotter than we do.
Yeah, Bullhead, Arizona is right across the river there from them. Now, when they sent you to school, where did they decide to send little John to school?
I don't know who you mean by they. I chose to go to Le Cordon Bleu, Culinary Arts here in Las Vegas.
Well, I'm talking about as a child, as a six-year-old. What
oh,
did they do?
Oh, I'm sorry.
What did they do then when the parents decided to... Did they send you to the blind school or the public school or what?
About the time that I was getting ready to enter school, I think, and I've never asked press for too many details about it, but there was something that was being organized here called Friends of the Visually Impaired. And the idea was that parents that in Las Vegas that had blind children of their own wanted to do the best they could to make sure that their kids grew up in, you know, not isolated from society, but a part of it. And so they began getting into the schools. The idea was to have these, all of us kids go to school with all of the other sighted kids, but to have the resources that we needed to get through our classes.
All right.
And so that's how it was from the time I entered kindergarten until I graduated high school, and it's still going. So my parents did consider putting me in a school for the blind when I was about 10 or 11 years old up in Utah, but they decided against it.
But now, so you would go to normal school, but you would go 1 hour a day to a resource room?
I always had a resource room that I could go to if I needed something read to me, or if I just needed help. I always had that resource room.
But there were other blind children there going to school with you,
right? Not very many. The most I think there were at my school in any 1 year I was there was maybe 20.
How did you associate with the sighted kids also in school?
Yes, up until I got into junior high school, most of my friends were sighted, and then I got into junior high and things changed pretty dramatically.
I think
there's a point when kids, you know, young kids. In fact, I went and spoke to I have a little niece that's about 8 years old, and her third grade class a few months ago had career day at their school, and my little niece called me up on the phone all nervous and said, "Uncle John, would you come talk to my third grade class about what it's like to be a chef?" And I went and spoke to their class, and I told them immediately, I said, "I may not face you, but I am looking at you. I can't see well." And they were very, very accepting, but I think there comes a point with kids when they realize, they start to notice the differences, and with a lot of kids, different is bad. Society, I think, teaches kids that different is bad. And so I lost a lot of my sighted friends and even some of my blind friends that I'd had.
Yeah, and then they get to the age where they want to, the strong pick on the weak.
Yes, that happened to me quite a bit.
With kids, and I guess at a younger age, I've often said that I didn't I realized I was blind before I went to school, but it didn't make any difference when I was between the ages of 2 and 6 when I played with all the neighborhood kids. And even after then, until I met all those other blind kids, I didn't realize my world was going to be that much different than anyone else's. And I guess you had basically the same the same experience. So you came to junior high. Were your grades good? Did you keep up?
I did good in my grades through about the eighth grade, and then the second half of my eighth grade year, all the way through high school, my experiences in school were extremely difficult. I was trying to grow up with a disability around other people who did not have a disability and had a difficult time relating to people with disabilities. Even my own family, you know, as much as they cared about me, had, you know, I look back at it now and I think my family realized that I was struggling but didn't know what to do. And it really climaxed about my sophomore and junior year when everyone started getting their driver's licenses and I didn't have that kind of freedom.
Yeah, that's true. But then, you know, if they had sent you to Nevada has a school for the blind, Utah we know does. If they'd sent you to blind school, you wouldn't have had that problem, but you may have had some other problems when you got out of school, then being thrown back into society where there aren't any other blind people except you. So I don't have any idea what is best.
I look back at it now, and I think that what my parents did, I mean, I wouldn't change anything about it, even though it was incredibly difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, because you couldn't date, and you everybody else had a girlfriend in the car, and there you were.
Yep.
That's tough on kids, 16-year-old. They don't understand that.
Yeah.
It's tough enough being 16, much less being denied those things. We're going to talk in a little bit about you going to, you went to a culinary school of some sort. Did your interest in cooking begin as a child? When did you decide you liked to cook?
No, food was never a big deal in my family. My parents both grew up on, my mom grew up on a ranch in Idaho and my dad grew up on a farm 20 miles away. So the only food that was ever made a big deal of in my family was beef. Because we knew what good beef was, but I didn't realize that food was something I could really enjoy and experience until I, in late grade school, met a friend whose entire family were vegetarians. And I did a lot of overnighters at his house, and the food they had for me to eat was very different. And at first I turned my nose up at it. I'm not eating this weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, about 2 o'clock in the morning when you wake up and you haven't eaten in 18 hours, anything starts to sound really good. And I slowly started to come around and realize that, you know, this food may be different, but this is good stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that helped to really open my mind to the idea that food was something that could not only, you know, make me feel full, but could really be experienced. But I took up cooking just after I graduated high school when I was living at home and was getting worn out on the frozen food and the fast food routine, because nobody in my family ever cooked very much except around the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at that point, I was just learning to use speech software on my old Pentium 286 computer. First computer I really had any experience with.
We're into the 90s by now, though, right?
This is into the mid. Yeah, this would have been about 1996.
Yeah.
But I was starting to go online and use the internet, and I figured, I put two and two together, and I thought, you know, I can learn how to cook if I go online and look for recipes. I can certainly make recipes of my own, and it started out as a necessity, then it became a hobby, and then it became a career.
But you didn't do any other college. You didn't start at a junior college and get any.
No, high school was so difficult for me that it took me nearly 10 years between when I graduated high school and when I decided I was going to go back to school.
All right, so you just stayed home then, read books, played on the computer?
I became a client of the Bureau of Services for the Blind, tried to find a job, actually managed to find a couple of jobs to keep me busy, and took as much mobility training and living skills training as I could possibly get my hands on, computer training also. So I was, during that time, I was just trying to figure out how to live in society as, you know, a blind person.
Yeah. Which is, takes some doing, if, you know, it, if even that the best of us, it takes a, takes a little inventiveness of how to, as to how to do it. I tell you what, let's, let us take a little break here, and we want to come back and we want to talk about, more about your interest in food and food preparation. Our guest is Jonathan Rawlings. I'm Phil Parr. More of Blind Like Me in just a minute. Hang on.
I like the best about the Blind Handyman List, great place to exchange information and gather ideas on anything to do with being a handyman around the house.
I found out how to fix my garbage disposal on the Handyman List, and it worked.
If you'd like to join the Blind Handyman List, send a blank email to blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
The thing I like about the Blind Handyman List, I'm the moderator, and I can delete you if I want to. So don't get out of line, stay on topic.
That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. A trip to Walmart.
I wonder where the pharmacy is. It's somewhere over here. Oh, God, I've got my cane caught in something.
Pardon me, sir. I don't know how to tell you this, but the end of your cane is stuck in my...
Why bother shopping the big discount stores when you can shop from the comfort of your own home at BlindMySmart.com?
Hi, this is Dale Campbell, president of Blind My Smart. If you can't find what you're looking for today, check back tomorrow. We're adding new products every day.
Blind My Smart, with thousands of products at a completely accessible website. Our address is blindmysmart.com. Again, that's www.blindmysmart.com.
Guest is Jonathan Rawlings from Las Vegas, Nevada, and interested in culinary things. Culinary looked at had experience with some folks who were vegetarians as a youngster, and realized that that food can be made tasty. You can put enough pepper on almost anything to eat it. We of course, as you get older, you eat more. Most people eat more vegetables. I eat a lot more now than I did. I've always liked some, but there are many I still don't like. And I can't imagine being a vegetarian and not eating any chicken or pork or beef.
Yeah, the only meat of any kind they had, even on special occasions, was fish once in a while.
Well, I've developed quite an appetite for fish. I like it. I enjoy going to seafood restaurants. Of course, fish is big now. Fish is big with the public, with society now.
Yep.
Okay, so you realized at age 27, 26, maybe I'll go somewhere and have someone teach me to cook. And there was close to you a place that could fulfill that desire, correct?
Yes. In fact, a friend of mine, a lot of people had been telling me, you know, seeing my passion for food, I had a lot of friends tell me, you should try going to culinary school. And as soon as I heard the word school, I shut down, remembering what a drudgery it had been to get through high school. But when I finally moved out on my own, I started looking at a culinary school that was running advertisements all over TV, and still is, by the way. But I figured I'd check them out. It certainly couldn't hurt to go to school and see what they were all about. but the person, that my recruiter that I contacted when I called him in school, and about 8 months after I made that first phone call, I found myself sitting in my first class.
Now, you said you moved down on your own. How were you able to afford to do that? Did you have someone subsidizing you, or did you have a little job? Or
I managed to. I'm still on the Social Security system, and I have a roommate that helps, that splits the rent with me.
Okay.
Which makes it just barely affordable enough I can.
You barely handle it.
Yep.
Okay, so you found yourself sitting in class, and this guy that was recruiting you knew you couldn't see.
Yes. My first conversation with him on the phone, I told him, I said, this is a very serious decision for me because I am visually impaired, and I would need to come into the school and look around and get a feel for what I'm in for. And I think that's part of why he was so patient with me over an eight-month period. Never went more than a few weeks without calling to say, you know, where are you? Are you still thinking about it, or are you still interested?
Well, you think he wanted to see if a visually impaired person could do it? Or what do you think?
I found out later, after I had started class, I was a little direct with him. You know, I can be very direct.
Yeah, I noticed that. I like it.
But I asked him, I said, you know, you never gave up on me. Being a student, I mean, a lot of people would have just written me off. You know, there's no way a blind person can do this. I said, what was it that led you to be so persistent? And he said, from the first time that you came in here to meet with me, your passion for food was so evident that I figured that would be enough to overcome any obstacles you might have with your visible.
Right, without knowing it, he was.
I didn't even know he was right until later.
He was correct. Okay, so you enrolled in school, and you're sitting in a classroom setting at a desk, or what physical deal?
A large table. My first class was food science and safety, which was all lecture, and I had been working with a person at the school who worked with kids with special needs, what few there were on campus there, and I'm sitting here, the students are being told to go home, read 60, 70 pages, and come back in ready to take notes on it the next day, and I didn't have my book on tape. I didn't have it in any format that I could read. And about a third of my classes, I either didn't have the book at all, or I had an outdated version. So basically, I got through it just by sitting and listening to the teacher taking. It was primarily a note-taking class.
Okay, so you just listened well enough in class to be able to absorb enough material. And any one of the sighted kids could have done the same thing, couldn't they, if they just paid attention?
Yeah, they could have. They could have, but they were all, you know, they all were taking down the notes, and there were videos that we would watch occasionally. But it was not a very interactive class until about the last two or three days. But I managed to absorb enough information from the lectures that I got through all my tests very easily.
But the rest of them were taking notes, and you weren't.
Nope.
You were just listening and putting it all upstairs where it needed to be.
Nope.
Okay, so this guy lectured a while. How did he give you a test?
I would be given my test, as this was all worked out before I started classes, and I would go to the library where this woman would read me my tests and write in my answers. So
okay.
I would be excused from the class and told to come back when I was finished, and we had a quiz. You know, because it was such a fast-paced class, each class in the entire program is only 3 weeks long. So they had to cram a lot of information, and we'd have three or four tests in a single day sometimes. But I did have someone who could read me my tests and would fill in the answers.
Okay, so this is a pretty big operation here. This is not some guy in a motel room talking to people about how to fry an egg. This is a pretty big deal. These folks have a campus. They have a library. They teach several different classes in food preparation, food science, food safety, you say. So how big is this? What is it called, and how big is it? Tell us about it.
It's the name of the school is the Cordon Bleu College of Culinary Arts in Las Vegas. There's about 10 campuses in the United States, but the main headquarters for the United States are in Chicago, but ultimately everything is run out of Paris. But the school has most of the largest classes have anywhere from 30 to 35 students per class, and I would say at any given time there's about 500 or 600 students on campus.
Really? So it's a big deal. I mean, this is not, like I said, not some fly-by-night thing. This is, these people are serious.
No, this is a big deal. In fact, my overwhelming student loans prove it's a very big deal.
And it happened to be, you say, 3 blocks from your current residence?
No, the school was a good 4 or 5 miles to the northwest of where I live. I had to take, we have a door-to-door service here called paratransit.
Okay.
That got me to and from school. But the 3 blocks was where I did my, at the end of the 12 months that you spend on campus, you're also required to complete 480 hours of actual on-job experience.
Okay.
Before you can graduate. And the restaurant that I chose to work at was only 3 blocks from me.
Now, you say you complete 12 months of training. Do they tell you in advance, they have a degree plan or a study plan for you, they tell you what classes you're going to take?
You know exactly which classes you're going to take. When you go to the school for the tour of the campus, you get a firsthand look. The classes are designed with huge windows so that when prospective students are looking around, they can look right into the classrooms and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you're told this will be your first class, then you'll move into this section and you'll learn about this, and you can see the students doing it as the recruiter is explaining what you'll learn.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you were terrified the first day because you didn't have any idea how you were going to. Did you think you'd be able to retain enough information to take the test, or you didn't? I'm amazed you didn't set up some way to record the lectures.
You know, that was in what few lecture classes are on the campus. I actually did in my second lecture class. I finally started recording some of the lectures, but in the kitchens, which is what most of what's on the campus, the kitchens you have, most of the kitchens are very, very large,
yeah,
and they echo badly enough that recording the lectures wouldn't have been very practical.
Yeah. Okay, so, but this first class, 3-week class, was a lecture class. You got through that first test, immediate relief. Oh, hell, I may be able to do this.
Right.
Got through the first test. Second thing, was it lecture or was it hands-on?
The next class was mostly hands-on, and it was a class where the primary objective was to teach us how to use our knife and to cut very, very precise, specific cuts from different vegetables. And that,
okay,
yeah, that I cut myself 5 different times in that 3-week class. My classmates got a good laugh when I showed up to class one morning with band-aids on 3 of my fingers.
But there were some sighted kids who cut themselves also.
Yes, but not as often as I did.
Not as often as you
but
did.
Everybody, no matter how good or bad their eyesight is, everybody, even the professional chefs that have been working 30 years, would cut themselves.
Because these knives are incredibly sharp.
Right.
They're honed to a razor's edge so that, you can, there's always been the theory that, and I've always believed in this, that you can hurt yourself a lot worse with a dull knife than you can a sharp knife.
That is absolutely true.
Because with a dull knife, you're putting a lot more pressure than you should be.
A dull knife cuts more, it cuts more skin, it takes longer to heal, and it's going to be more sore, whereas a sharp knife, yeah, it can cut deeper, but you're going to heal faster and it won't hurt as much.
But I'm sure they have facilities there, first aid facilities for people who cut themselves in the kitchen there.
Every classroom has, at the chef's desk, has a drawer with all the necessary first aid equipment, including for burns, which happened more than once.
Okay, they started out teaching you to cut up vegetables like squash.
But the primary vegetables we use for practice were potatoes because they're so large and they can be cut into larger things that can then be cut in, you know, into smaller pieces.
Uh-huh.
But we had to learn how to, you know, all the dimensions of the various cuts, small, medium, large, dice, julienne, fine julienne. I mean, there's about 15, 16 different shapes that we had to learn how to cut before we could leave that class.
I thought julienne fries were done by a machine. Can you do that with your knife?
I can do that with my knife if I really concentrate on it. It's very difficult. I did it well enough to get through the class, But in most professional restaurants, especially with a lot of turnover, yeah, things like that are done by they're in fact, I got one for Christmas that's called a mandolin, and you can it'll julienne. All you have to do is move your hand back and forth, and the blade cuts it in the perfect julienne. But that's not good enough at this school. You have to learn to do it by hand.
Well, yeah, because you'd want to be able to do it by hand. And so this second class was in the kitchen, and it was largely was cutting up vegetables. Surely they didn't spend 3 weeks on that, did they?
No, there was. We started learning the basics of cooking things like how to sauté. You know what the culinary definition of sauté versus shallow fry versus deep fry. We learned all of those things, and we also started touching on the five basic sauces that French cooking is based on, and how to make sauces and soup, and not just any soup, but the way the French do it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it wasn't all sitting there playing with the knife all day. there was some cooking.
And so you say that you got burned a couple of times?
Yeah, that just happened. You know, it didn't happen in that class, but it happened in later classes. In one class in particular, I burned myself pretty good.
I have no culinary expertise other than I can fry sausage and I can cook eggs and I do limited cooking. I can if we're making if we're doing enchiladas, for instance, I can cook the hamburger meat and put the onions and taco sauce or enchilada sauce in. But I find that if you know that pan's hot, you can touch it real quick as long as you don't leave your hand there.
Right.
You can if you're frying sausage, you can put your hand down on, you know, you don't want to touch the skillet. You don't want to leave your hand there too long. But if you accidentally touch the bottom of the skillet, it's not going to kill you.
Right.
So you're cutting, you're sautéing, you're learning to, did they deep fry some?
The deep frying came in a later class, but yes, there's deep frying. They teach you how to properly bread things.
Okay.
And yeah, there's deep frying going on there too.
Okay, so the first class was lecture, second class was in the kitchen, third 3 weeks consisted of what? Do you remember?
My third class was another lecture class. I'm trying to remember back to what it was, what the title it was. There were two subject matters that we covered. Kitchen. I think the class was called kitchen management. And we basically learned how. Basically would learn how to be comfortable getting up in front of people, how to sit and write instructions for a recipe. From a chef's perspective, you know, you might have a new employee that, in fact, this happened in my class. One of the projects in my third week class was to sit down as a group and write out how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in such a way that if the person had never done it before, they could do it successfully. And it was really a fun project because one of the kids in our class was from China, and he had never had one before.
He had never had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich?
He had never had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in his entire life. He was 31, and at the end of the class, you have to exchange, with other groups, you have to exchange the instructions, and that group gets up in front of the class and makes it. And he got to eat his. We let him keep his, and he said, "Now I know why it is such a... American tradition. It is wonderful." We had a lot of fun with him in our class.
A sighted person making a peanut butter and jelly. Of course, the basic deal is you get out two slices of bread. You lay one on the surface of a plate or something, and you dip out some peanut butter, spread it on the bread, and then you put some jelly on that, and then you put the top piece of bread on. That's the basic. I mean, that's how I would make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. A sighted person would dip out that peanut butter and would be looking all the time and spreading that peanut butter evenly with a knife, whereas you couldn't do that.
I could do that, but I had to get close. I had to get my face kind of close to what I was doing. When it came my group's turn to make someone else's, follow someone else's directions, my group of course. Picked me to do it. I figured they wanted someone to laugh at. And at this point, it's a cohort program, so you have the same classmates from the first class to the last.
Yeah.
So I'd gotten to be getting friends with someone with some of my classmates, and they just thought that was the funniest thing they'd ever seen in their life. The blind guy up there making PB&J. Well, they had quite a bit to learn when I got into the next class and started deep frying and sauteing stuff, and fire was everywhere.
Well, but then you had to not become offended by that. That's your job to if they think that's funny, then it is.
Well, it wasn't so much that it was. I mean, I saw the humor in it, the irony in it, but it got to be a little more serious later on when certain people would be overly concerned for me burning myself or dropping something. And I had to kind of tell them, I said, you know, I'm here to learn just as much as you are. And if I drop something or I burn myself, it's not like my life's going to end. It happens.
Yeah, the world's not going to end because you drop something. There's people around. All right, let's take our little second break, and then what an interesting thing for a blind person to go through to attempt. I've got to applaud you for attempting this. Whether you ever become the super chef at Delmonico's or not, you did it. You went through cooking school and I think lots of my other blind people would agree. That was a great thing to do. Whether you can parlay it into a wonderful job and make $1 million, I don't know. But it was a hell of a thing to do. I wish I had the nerve to do it. If I was 30 years younger, I would. All right, let's take a break, and I'll quit talking here, and we'll play a couple commercials and be back. Jonathan Rawlings from Las Vegas, Nevada, Culinary School. Back in just a minute.
Search team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sites, here's Tim Cummings.
One of the catalog stores which has become quite famous and does have a presence on the web is Land's End, www.lands.com. It's a store primarily for buying clothes for kids or adults, but they do have luggage and some other things. And it's a very accessible website. It's nice because when you do find a particular piece of clothing that you want, they will tell you what to describe the color and the material and so on and so forth, so you can get quite a lot of detail on the site. And if you do need help, there's an 800 number that you can also call if you're stuck for some reason. I would give these Land's End a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. And the website again is www.landsend.com. For Blind Sights, this is Tim Cummings saying keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
Everybody, any more blind like me from let's get going again here. My stopwatch. Jonathan Rawlings is our guest from Las Vegas, Nevada. He went to a very well organized culinary school. I think you said they had maybe 6 campuses throughout the United States, and this school devotes itself to the art of French cooking. Correct?
It is French techniques. It's a combination of French cooking techniques and American cuisine.
Mm-hmm. Which, go ahead.
The basic cooking principles were French, but the foods, most of the foods that we made were classic American dishes.
Uh-huh, but the way they're made is more French.
Correct.
Okay, so but you didn't find, we were talking a while ago about the kids. I thought it was really pretty funny to watch a blind guy make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. If I were making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, I would put the peanut butter on the bread in a lump and probably take my hand and spread it around. Of course, you couldn't do that, could you?
No, and it probably wouldn't have been allowed to have happened anyhow because, you know, the big thing in the school is food safety. You know, would you serve that to a customer?
Yeah.
I wasn't able to do that.
Because Dale and I have talked several times about the use. You know Dale Campbell does Cooking in the Dark.
Oh yeah, I know of him.
And so we talk a lot about using your, if you're going to make it, if you're making it for yourself, or even if I was making it for my wife, you take my hand and spread that peanut butter around. I would do the same thing with the jelly, and then I would slap another piece of bread on it, and bingo, we got a peanut butter jelly sandwich. Whereas you couldn't in school, couldn't do that. You had to do it with a knife.
Right.
So your little amount of sight that you have came in very handy there.
Very useful for that day.
Yeah, for that day. Making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. How involved did they get?
The point of the exercise wasn't, obviously everyone in the class knew how to do it, but the point of the exercise that day was, how specific can you write directions for a recipe for someone who's never done it before? And when my group did it, we had, believe it or not, we had 37 steps that had to be followed in order to do it correctly. So it was very, very involved. And then we'd come, the class might have been split up into six groups, and we would all exchange our directions, and one person in that group had to go up and do it and see how well written those directions were. My directions, my one assignment got the highest grade because I only had one mistake in that I had forgotten to write that the jar of peanut butter needed to be set down before being spread out. So, I mean, very, very detailed things like that.
Yeah, and this was to teach you to teach other people.
Correct.
Okay. All right, then this is the third class, and then what do we get into next? We're at about three, you've gone through about 12 weeks of the class, which would be 3 months, or 9 weeks, or whatever. What did they get into next?
The next class I went into after that was called Skills 2, and it basically built on the things that we had learned in the class where I was learning to use my knife and make soups and sauces.
Mm-hmm.
That class was the first real exposure I had to what it would be like to work in a real kitchen. It was a gigantic kitchen. Our classes were split up into groups of four or five people, and we were given an entire menu that our group had to make within about 4 to 4.5 hours. And not just for ourselves, but other students from other classes would come in and eat that food. We had to have it done by a certain time of the night.
Okay, so your group was cooking while the others were watching, or what?
No, everyone in the entire class had to make their menu.
Okay.
And that food was then served to the rest of the student body.
All right.
While they were, so we were cooking while they were in their various classes.
There had to be, before we do that, you said then eventually they taught you a class, they taught you how to deep fry.
Yeah, this was in Skills 2.
This was in Skills 2,
okay. This was in this class I'm talking about now.
Okay.
We had one day where everything on the menu was deep fried. We did onion rings, french fries, chicken, and fish.
And everything was deep fried.
Right.
Any accidents?
A Southerner's dream come true.
Yeah, which I would say I live in a high-fry, low-sushi area of the world. That's how I describe East Texas. Now, any accidents in your deep-frying experience?
Actually, no. One of the other people on my group that I was working with that day, when it actually came time to cook the stuff I had made, I got the strong impression he was trying to stay ahead of me so that I wouldn't go hurt myself, and I had to, in no uncertain terms, I had to tell him, I have to learn to do this stuff too.
Yeah.
Now get out of my way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he got the message, but no, there were no accidents on deep fry day.
Of course, the basic, I guess everybody knows, but the basic premise of deep frying is you take oil in a pot or a pan or a skillet and get it hot, what, about 350?
Depending on what you're cooking, anywhere from 300 up to 375.
Okay, that's hot. Right. And so then you take a basket, and you put your potatoes in that basket, and you dip them down into that oil, leave them for a certain length of time, and this basket is porous, it has holes in it, then you pull it back up, and the oil drips out of the holes of the basket, and bingo, you have French fries.
Right.
And that's the way you were taught to do it. That's basic, I mean, just run a quick run through.
That's exactly how deep frying works. The food is completely submerged in the oil while it's cooking.
Yeah, so blind people who think they can't deep fry, actually, it's a fairly blind-friendly thing to do if you're careful.
Yeah, as long as you don't knock the container with the oil over or sticking your hand in it,
yeah.
And then you're going to be fine. It's a very simple way of cooking.
It is. But
the results are oh so wonderful.
Oh, the results are wonderful. I'm starving it. I'm having Braunschweiger and crackers for lunch, and that's the way it is. Now, let me say this. And so you deep fried and probably did that about as well. How did you judge the temperature of the oil? You didn't have a talking. Did you have a talking thermometer?
At the time, no, I didn't.
You do now, I guess.
At that particular point in the schooling program, I had to rely on my sighted friends to let me know when I could get a general idea on the chicken when the coating had gotten nice and brown, you know, that nice golden color that sighted people hoot and holler about. But they were able to help me figure out when it was done, and I just learned to time it from there.
Well, and also there's a certain noise things make when you dip them in the oil. And you can't tell the temperature by that noise, but you can tell if you got it hot enough.
Yeah, you can. Yes, and that's something that I'm still trying to learn here at home. I've been trying to deep fry chicken here at home, on a chicken on the bone, for the last several months, and for some reason, I have never been able to get the same results here at home that I got when I was in school. But when it goes in, it makes it starts out. You're looking for a certain noise. How much it sizzles or pops at you.
Yeah.
And then as it continues to cook, the sound, you know, and more moisture is pulled out of the food, that noise gets softer and softer.
It gets deeper or it changes. There is a definite change in that noise.
Right.
And you can, if you've heard sighted people do it or you've done it yourself, you can tell a lot by that noise I like to hear an egg. When I drop the egg in the skillet, I want to hear that noise.
Yep.
I want to hear that noise, or I go turn the skillet up because, well, we ain't cooking it for that. And hear that noise. I know that's
right.
Not good. But so you deep fried. You have learned to cut up vegetables. What else? What other?
There is a total of 16 classes. This class that I was talking about, deep frying, that's only the fourth one.
Yeah.
But some of the other classes down the hall, there was beginning baking and pastry, which was is actually one of my favorite things to do. I love the specifics of baking, and the fact that it doesn't have to be tended. You know, you mix the stuff up, you put it in the oven, it takes care of itself, and when you pull it out, it's basically done.
Yeah.
That's it. And I like being able to do that. But I struggled quite a bit because as the classes go further into the program, it gets more and more intense. And the practical exams, especially for this class, are extremely difficult. We had 4 hours and 15 minutes to make five completely different items with very limited resources, like the ovens and the stoves and the mixers. I honestly look back and I don't know how I passed that class, but somehow I eked through it.
But you passed the entire course load, and you got a final certificate from this culinary school.
Right. I managed to make it all through advanced baking. There's garmage. We did. There was one class that was almost more of an arts and crafts than it was a cooking. We did sausage making. And then at the very end of the program, you spend 6 weeks in a restaurant that actually serves the public.
Uh-huh.
And the kitchen is wide open for those people to look in and see what you're doing.
Okay, real quickly, because we're almost out of time, where did you do that?
The restaurant is on one far end of the campus, and so it's actually at the school.
Oh, it's their restaurant.
Right.
Okay. What do you think you can do with this certificate, sir?
What I hope to be able to do is eventually to just find my niche in the culinary world, wherever that ends up taking me. But as long as I get to make something with food, I'll be pretty happy. I don't know if I'll ever be a chef of, like Emeril Lagasse or something like that. But
you'd like to make a living cooking.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I had a job interview Saturday that looks very, very promising. I'm expecting him to call back today.
We are completely at the end here. Jonathan, do me a favor. When you get a job, will you call me?
Absolutely.
Well, put me high on the list of people you call. I admire you and bless your heart. You did a good thing. Whether you ever make a living at it or not, you did something you wanted to do, and hats off to you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Rawlings from Las Vegas, Nevada. Sir, I'll call you and let you know when we run this, all right?
Okay, and I should know within the next 24, 48 hours whether it's actually at the New York Casino.
You give me a call.
I will.
Thank you, sir.
Bye.
Bye. You got to give that boy credit for what he's done. I hope he's able to do something with his newfound skills in cooking. By the way, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, you can contact me at phil@philparr.net, or you can call me at 936-634-9500. We'd like to hear from you. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, you know somebody who you think would make us a good guest. Don't forget our gathering in November, November 3rd, 4th, 5th, and go home on the 6th in Houston, Texas. Coming up this November, we started early, so you can't say this time, you can't say, well, I didn't know about it. You should have told me earlier, because we're telling you right now that it's going to happen in November, this coming November, and we hope you'll come and be a part of it. We'd like to see you. Thanks again for listening. Phil@philparr.net, that's how you contact us, or phone 936-634-9500. We'll see you next time, another little show called Blind Like Me.